Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 106, featuring the return of Kevin Mack. Yes, this is his second time on the podcast. I absolutely love Kevin Mack. Those of you who listened to the first podcast will know that, which is number 44 for those of you who haven't listened to it. And in fact, if you want to listen to this one, I would recommend you stop, pause, or whatever, and go back to listen to episode number 44, where we learn a lot about where Kevin comes from and the legacy that he has done. Basically, just the short version is he's an amazing visual effects guy and comes from a huge legacy of visual effects from even back to his family and everything. And his wife as well is incredible. Snow is just an amazing person. And they basically gave everything up to be fine artists. And the area or the medium that they want to express their fine art is actually in virtual reality. And based on the amazing amount of knowledge that he has from visual effects and everything else, he's able to create some very, very interesting pieces in VR. So a little over a year that I last talked to him, and I wanted to talk to him a little bit more about VR, specifically about some of the things we've learned over time and what he's learned and how he's been able to evolve these things. And it's really great. We speak a lot about how to move in VR because there's a lot of people that are making up quote-unquote rules about it, and he doesn't necessarily agree with those rules. And I got to tell you, I think he's right in a lot of ways. I think he's succeeded in moving in VRs in ways that people told you you're not allowed to move in VR. But it was a really, really great conversation. So if you want to check out some of his artwork, I would highly recommend it if you have a VR headset of some kind. So if you have a Gear VR, you can go check out the piece he's done there, which is a pre-rendered thing. It's all done in Houdini. Yeah, I think it is, yes. And so that's pre-rendered content that's done in there. It's really, really great, and it's called Zen Parade. So go check out Zen Parade. It's available on the Oculus Store for the Gear VR. Now, if you want to check out his newest thing, which is a full real-time interactive version, basically, of Zen Parade called Blurtasia, go look up Blurtasia, and there'll be links on the podcast page. So go back to the podcast page and we'll put it up there. That is available on the Steam store for the Vive and allows you to basically just fly around his abstract art piece. And he does it very, very well, very successful. A lot of people are worried about nausea or feeling and say, you know, just motion sickness. I'm severely prone to this stuff, honestly, which is ironic because I am doing a lot of work in VR, and I was not really affected at all by his stuff. And I think there's a lot of good reasons and why they work, and we talk about that. Anyway, it's a great podcast. I really enjoy it. Hope you guys enjoy it as well. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Last time you were on the podcast, which was about a little over a year, almost a year and 3 months ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
It was back at THU 2015, and it was episode 44, which I recommend people go back and listen to that one to get some of your back history, because I don't necessarily want to talk too much about that. But you were doing some very interesting things exploring in VR. You were looking at shape space. Now, what was it, the specific project? Tell people about the names.
Well, shape space began as the name of my first experiment.
Right.
And it was just a minute and a half. And we started demoing that and showing it to people. And they just freaked out. It was really successful. So I thought, well, I got to, you know, this was an experiment. I want to take this a little further.
Right.
And then it occurred to me, well, now it's going to be different and I need a new name. And we really liked the ShapeSpace name. So we decided we'd just make that the name of the company.
Right. Okay.
And then Zen Parade was the first released piece we did.
And it was really cool. And back then, the way that experiment was all pre-rendered, mm-hmm. content. Just to give a people idea, it's an art piece. It's a fine art piece that's kind of something you really need to experience to see it, to understand what it is.
Yeah, that's I think the biggest challenge we face doing this stuff is that because it is something people have never experienced before, they have no context for it. They have no frame of reference. Mm-hmm. And it makes it really impossible to describe it to someone.
Right.
And you can. I mean, you can certainly describe it. People describe it to each other. And that description makes sense and is coherent if you've seen it.
Right.
But if you haven't seen it, people just don't have any idea. And we it's hard to anticipate
sure.
that because, well, we've seen it.
Right.
And when we talk to people about it, they've seen it.
Right.
And one of the things, the feedback we get often is you tell people about it and they go, oh, well, that sounds interesting and everything. And then they see it. And they're like, oh my God, I had no idea.
Right.
Like I didn't realize. And I mean, even when we post pictures and video
mm-hmm.
and elaborate, you know, descriptions,
right.
people say, no, that I had no idea.
Right.
Didn't understand.
It is an experience. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit, but I want to make sure we sort of talk about the evolution of what we've done in VR, because that is an experience that's pre-rendered with 3 degrees of freedom, right? So you can't necessarily move around, but it is stereo and you can look around.
Yes.
And it's not spherical video that a lot of people are reclaiming. You actually can see full stereo and everything in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that was one of the things we solved early on. And of course, you know, it's readily available now, but
right.
At the point we were doing that, there was no way to really render stereo 360.
Right.
And so we solved that. And the other thing is it was 3 degrees of freedom and mm-hmm. it was pre-rendered because that was what I could do at the time.
Right.
And the Gear VR was kind of the only game in town.
Well, other more than the mass early, adoption, right.
Yeah, the Rift, you know, I got a DK too and was fooling around with that. But
right.
It just, it wasn't quite there yet.
And you couldn't buy a Rift in a store, right?
Exactly.
You can go to and get a Gear VR. So and actually there's a lot of Gear VRs out there right now.
Yeah.
And so anyone who has a Gear VR can actually get Zen Parade, right?
Yeah. It's in the Oculus store.
Okay.
And it still seems to hold up. It's interesting because, you know, the sales go up and down with if they feature us on the Samsung Pix or not, and we're
right.
kind of buried in apps, which
right.
is maybe not appropriate, but people continue to find it. But because initially we had it as a free, you know, we gave it away for free
mm-hmm.
and you got a minute of it for free, but then you had to, it was an in-app purchase thing, which of course got all kinds of backlash because Oculus didn't tell anybody they had that option.
Okay.
But nonetheless, we had a lot of users from that. And
okay.
now it's just a paid app. But the big thing is it's kind of remarkable watching how many people continue to use it.
Yeah.
It's just like it's got pretty high use numbers.
I know that, you know, I've seen it many times, but you also were gracious enough to let me show it to some people. And every time people see it, their reactions are amazing. And they always vary too. There are some people going, I don't know what I just saw, but that was crazy. Or some people's like, oh, this is what VR is for. Like there's all these different reactions that people
mm-hmm.
have, which is kind of really trippy. And especially different ages have different reactions to it as well.
Yeah. It's that's part of the, you know, the art of it is
right.
that it is abstract art
mm-hmm.
and is open to interpretation. There mm-hmm. is nothing really concrete to get a hold of and go, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's what this is. That's what this is
yeah,
about.
Yeah. It's not like you can say, remember when this thing happened?
Like, yeah.
No, it's just,
it forces, you know, it mines your own imagination, your own unconscious for its content.
Right. And, which is really, really kind of a great thing. And I guess at this point you wanted to go further with that and sort of develop more direction. Like you wanted to get the 6 degrees of freedom and get better overall interactive.
Yes. Yeah. Once I tried the riff, I mean the Rift and right. the Vive, mm-hmm. I thought, wow, this would be really cool. And we had a very fortunate little turn of events, mm-hmm. Which was Unity. You know, saw our company name on the roster of some, you know, VR expo or something, mm-hmm. and sent us an invitation to exhibit at the Unity Vision Summit.
Oh, right. I saw you there. That's right. I was there.
Yes. And so we were invited, but of course we couldn't afford to pay the
right.
a booth fee or whatever.
Well,
and, and so almost jokingly, I replied, like, cause it was kind of funny cause they were sending me this ad or email as if I were this big multi-million dollar company. And, mm-hmm. and so I said, well, hey, I'm just an artist and we can't afford to do this stuff very often, but you know, occasionally folks help us out because we got a really killer thing mm-hmm. that often is, you know, the hit of the show.
Right.
And and I didn't expect to hear anything back. And they said, really? Well, can we check it out? And uh-huh. so they sent a guy over to check it out.
Right.
Snow, my wife, yeah. Bought him a nice sandwich and and he really loved it,
right.
both the app and the sandwich.
Right.
And so he gave us the thumbs up and then they all invited us to come and show at the Vision Summit.
Yeah.
And we didn't have to pay anything. We got to go to the event. We got a free space. We were part of their showcase or whatever. And mm-hmm. it was great fun and we met lots of folks and it was a really wonderful event. And as part of that event, if you recall, everyone who came received a Vive.
Yeah.
And I really didn't expect to get one because we weren't paying customers. We were just the hired entertainment in a sense. And but we did. And I was so grateful to Unity. I'd never done any real-time stuff. And so I thought, well, I'm gonna give this Unity a go and see what I can do on the Vive. And mm-hmm. and I started experimenting and I was so blown away by what was possible. Mm. I've spent many years, every few years, I check back in with real time mm-hmm. and cause just, you know, it's the Holy Grail.
Right.
And I check back in and my kids who are grown now were avid gamers and always showing me the latest technology and everything. And,
right.
And I would look into it and get excited and then ultimately decide, just not good enough yet. It's not there. Right. I'm a fidelity, you know, aficionado. It's got to be a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And it finally crossed a threshold for me as I was experimenting and found that I could do some of the processes that I've been used to doing for many years in non-real-time rendering.
Mm-hmm.
It was possible to translate some of these weird techniques I use into real time.
Right.
And once I started experimenting, I had this one experiment that was really just a Unity learning exercise for me and a test to see, well, can I do this? Will this work? And how will I do that?
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty cool. And I started showing it to people and they were freaking out because I had developed a flying mechanic mm-hmm. that seemed to really work for people and didn't make anybody sick, even people who were used to getting, you know, a little motion sickness. So
right.
I decided, okay, well, once we'd showed it to more people and we demoed it to a big group at one point and the response was so positive, I turned it into Blurtasia.
Right. So we'll talk a little bit about Blurtasia in a bit, but specifically we'll just talk about it. Blurtasia mm-hmm. is the evolution of Zen Parade in a sense, right? In a lot of ways, it's a real-time experience. You have 6 degrees of freedom. On the Vive, you can walk around and actually get parallax and all of those other things.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is you have a new level of interactivity, right? So now you can use the controllers on the Vive and fly around.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm easily prone to motion sickness, although I do a lot of VR stuff or look at a lot of VR stuff. I am very prone to it. So I was nervous about flying, right? I was very nervous about the idea, but there's something that you're doing that I would love for you to explain that I'm only going to think of it. The best way I can say it is it's the proper amount of dampening as you take off or start flying and as you slow down, right?
Right, which are, of course, you know, in all of the best practices guidelines, you're not supposed to do that.
Really?
Yeah, the acceleration and deceleration is generally frowned on in the literature, the best practices stuff. But it's just not true. It's just
I think it
is in certain contexts. It is true.
Okay.
It's just that, and it's hard to explain because it's not one thing. It's like 80 things that make okay. it not make you sick. But the number one is in Blortasia. You are never rotated. You don't rotate in VR. You rotate yourself in the real world.
Right.
And that's really the great advantage of the Vive, of being able to turn around and around and look all around and
right.
walk all around even, makes that possible.
So the steering is completely done by your moving.
Well, you can steer in that you can point the controllers wherever you want to go.
Right.
And it's just like a gas pedal. You just squeeze the trigger and you go at whatever speed you squeeze.
Right.
And you can change their direction, aim them wherever you want to go, but it only moves you in that direction.
Okay.
It never rotates you.
Right.
But okay. people don't even realize it. They just instantly take to it because, you know, if you start going, I want to go over there, and you aim them over there, mm-hmm. the tendency is to turn your body in the direction you're going.
Right.
And so they do, and they don't realize that I'm never rotating them.
Right.
And they don't need a rotation control. They just point where they want to go uh-huh. and turn their body to, you know, and you can point them backwards and go backwards. You can go straight up or straight down.
Right.
And it doesn't, you know, your rotation is up to you.
And that does make a difference, I guess, the fact that you relinquish the rotation control back to the user, I guess.
No, yeah. Right. See, the big thing, and a lot of this I picked up over the years working in visual effects, mm-hmm. and it's long been a passion of mine, neuroscience and human perception. Mm-hmm. And it was very useful in visual effects to understand, you know, the order of operations, how we process information, and what are really important things to the brain in terms of fidelity in different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found, and what seemed pretty apparent to me, and again, it goes back to, I'm always looking at evolutionary biology to find the underlying causes and mechanisms mm-hmm. Behind things. And so it's this thing of, it's really that rotation is so vital to survival.
Okay.
The way the vestibular system works, you've got kind of two independent systems,
okay.
and one is for, you know, perceiving rotation, mm-hmm. and the other is for perceiving motion and acceleration.
Okay.
And the one for rotation is much more important, higher fidelity, higher priority than the one for motion.
Interesting.
Because, if you think about it. If you get a little glitch in your information about how you're oriented rotationally,
mm-hmm.
There's a pretty good chance you're going to fall down and hit your head and not even know that it happened until
right.
it's too late.
Yeah,
because you just won't feel it. You've lost your orientation.
I mean, you and I were talking about this earlier today about we both had, you know, bouts of vertigo and how
mm-hmm.
it was very disconcerting.
Yeah, it's really alarming.
Right.
And so the way I do this flying mechanic that keeps it from getting anybody ill is I negotiate with your brain on a number of levels.
Okay.
And the first trade is I go, okay, this rotation is super important to you,
right.
so that's all yours.
Okay.
I'm not going to touch it.
Right.
You have complete control there. You'll always have all the proper cues. There'll be no mismatch between your visual input and your other senses. You're gonna
right.
you're gonna get the feedback from your proprioceptive system and the vestibular system
mm-hmm.
are all gonna line up.
Okay.
And in exchange for that, all I want is a little bit of slack on the translation.
Right.
Acceleration, deceleration. But I'm not going to go too far. I'm not going to push it. All I'm going to ask for is and it's going to be, it's going to feel natural.
Right.
And so the motion is all physically based.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never do anything to you, never move in a way that isn't physically plausible.
Yeah.
And so you there's always mass, inertia, momentum. If you let go of the thrusters, if you decide to stop, you don't stop abruptly. You coast to a stop.
Yeah. It feels like swimming. In a way,
yeah,
because there is, it is, while we're calling it flying, it is very zero G kind of experience, right? Where you can just, you're floating
yeah,
the whole time.
There's no gravity.
Right. And you even have an option. It's interesting because it's people should go to the podcast page to see it, and we'll make sure I have a link to Plortasia. And if you guys have a Vive, I would definitely recommend to buy it because it's really cool. But there's also the idea of like there's a platform that you can stand on that gives you some kind of feeling of safety.
Yes, yes. And the platform is serves a couple of purposes. One, it gives you a grounding point and a point of reference spatially. But it's also it's optional. You can turn it off. A lot of people prefer to fly without it.
Mm-hmm.
But it really, I found that it's a comfort for some people, and it's not so much for the motion sensitive, but for the fear of flying.
Interesting.
Or a fear of falling, rather. Everyone has this natural fear of falling. What happens if you approach a ledge or a precipice of any kind is that your vestibular system and other parts of your brain go into a sort of hyperacuity. They become hyper attentive. They're suddenly you've intellectually, it's recognized there is, you know, one misstep and you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
So your brain suddenly goes, okay, let's pay special attention to all of, you know, the cues for the vestibular system, for everything. Let's make sure our balance is right on the money and everything is good.
But that effect is also very stimulating, right?
It is. That's why, you know, that's why people climb mountains and jump out of airplanes and stuff. It's for that thrill, because it does give you a little adrenaline thrill.
Right.
And it's, of course, a selection advantage, and has been for a long time, that if you can climb to the top of that tree and get that fruit or whatever it is, or that's an advantage.
Right.
And so we are greatly rewarded by being able to do a thing that scares us anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. I didn't think about the fact that it's an overcome, it's a courage thing, I guess.
And yeah,
it's
rewarded for it's interesting because people have different levels of it. Some people it's very minimal, and some people just have a total fear of heights.
Yeah.
And so the platform helps with that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, one of the things we do know, most, you know, the people often reference various theories about motion sensitivity and the vestibular system. But they are really just theories. There is no consensus in the scientific community about what causes it.
Yeah.
And, but there is consensus that it is, exposure reduces it.
The more you do it.
The more you do it. Sailors, you know, would start out on things. They'd start out as a sailor. First time at sea, they'd throw up for a week or two, and then it went away.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's not a fun process.
No.
But what I found with Plortasia is that by starting out people slow, they can just
there's a setting to let you go slowly.
You just go real slow at first. You just do what you're comfortable with. You can keep the platform on. You can go slow. You can stay close to the ground, whatever makes you comfortable. But little by little, people acclimate to this new thing, and your brain adapts, and pretty soon they're flying around like Superman with the platform turned off.
Right. Yeah. It's a really beautiful experience. I think I love the fact that it's sort of it's an exterior and an interior experience too, which I also like, you know, the fact that these portals that are there, you know, the holes that you walk through or fly through, and it just becomes really beautiful. I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I think it's a great idea, and I think it's something that I wish did more things in VR. And I want to sort of get at the idea. So, you know, a lot has happened in VR in the, you know, 16 months or whatever that we've last talked. And I'd love to know what you have learned in that time. Like, what's been some of the biggest learning things that you have picked up on? I mean, you mentioned something, obviously, about your experiences with flying and how that happened, which is a great revelation that you've learned in that time. But what other big things in VR have you learned that you think are interesting?
Well, I think that it's interesting because I've been thinking about VR my whole life.
Yeah.
I've spent most of my life in VR.
Yeah.
And I'm not so young anymore.
Nope.
So it's I've spent a lot of time there in that my imagination or whatever is pretty vivid.
Right.
And I've had these visions and so on. So I've had the idea of it, and the promise of it has been around for so long that I have spent a great deal of time fantasizing about what I would do and how things would work and what it would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, once I got to try things, some of them were, my assumptions were correct and some weren't.
Yeah.
But what I found, I've learned and have had to learn more than anything else in this, you know, last several months, is it's a whole other world in terms of culture and business and society, and it's like a whole other world. I came from the visual effects world and the mm-hmm. film business.
Yeah.
And now, you know, of course there are filmmakers involved with VR, but then there's also the game developers
mm-hmm.
and the indie game development is probably still the strongest corollary to developing for VR.
Yeah.
And I have zero experience there.
Mm.
So I've never worked on games really. Mm. I've followed them through my kids as they grew up.
Yeah.
But I actually seem to be missing something or whatever, because I think early on in the 80s, I tried, you know, playing with some of the first games, and I played with my kids over mm. the years here and there, but I've never had any great attraction to it. I honestly kind of don't get it.
Right.
And so it's an awkward thing now to be in this world that is largely the game development world.
Right.
And be so clueless, like literally like stranger in a strange land, don't understand the customs and the language and just feeling very insecure about some of those things. But what's been fantastic is that some of those people have been really helpful to me.
Oh, great.
And I have had, you know, top indie game developers reach out. They love my thing and they have helped me to, you know, and held my hand through the whole, you know, getting it onto Steam and what to expect and how to manage the expectations of gamers
yeah.
and all that. Because I really, you know, I have my own vision for VR,
mm-hmm.
which is not happening yet.
Right.
You know, it's not there yet. Everyone's seeing it as it's an extension of games or it's an extension of storytelling.
Right.
And I don't see it as that. And
right. And
I think as an artist, I that's what I see it as, the ultimate potential. And I still believe that art is kind of the ultimate medium for the medium,
mm-hmm.
because it is also an experiential medium. And art, you know, maybe it succeeds or doesn't. It's only
right.
had, you know, painting and sculpture and all of the various mediums that we have. And yet it still is very much about giving the viewer an experience more than it is telling them a story or engaging them in a game or something.
Well, it's such a different way of we talked about this a little bit. Let's go back to this thing that you were mentioning earlier when we were talking at lunch, is the idea of what VR is to you as you started to describe it, and how storytelling is about sort of narrative or something, or language. That's what you used. You used the word language. So describe that thing, because I think that was a very good way of describing it.
Yeah, I keep trying to come up with ways to explain my thought process on narrative in VR. And it's hard because, it winds up, it's hard to not make it like you're dissing storytelling or something.
Sure.
And it's not about that. They're different things. And of course, you can still tell a story in VR. You can do anything in VR. It's a reality.
Right.
So anything is possible. But the way I like to describe it now is that reality, or the human experience of reality, is stuff happening over time.
Okay.
It's very basic, very simple and mechanical. It's just we perceive stuff happening over time.
Right.
And that's a thing. That's our experience of reality, our first person experience. Storytelling or narrative is when we use language to tell each other about stuff happening over time.
Right.
And in so doing, we provide it with context and meaning.
Right.
And this is a wonderful thing. This is why there is this massive worldwide religion built around storytelling.
Right.
It's people are really, really into it because it is central to who we are as humans. We tell each other stories. Mm-hmm. Storytelling is essentially language.
Right.
And so it's a really important thing. And of course you can do that in VR, but VR gives us an entirely new capability that we've never had before, which is to communicate the first person experience of stuff happening over time. Mm-hmm. We can directly communicate experience.
Right.
And that experience of spatial presence or of being in a place is an incredibly powerful thing, and I don't think people realize yet how powerful it is. It's not just a tool or an enhancement or an extension of storytelling and games and things we know about. It opens up the door to possibilities we have never imagined because it is actual experience.
And I think it's a really good way to put it, because one of the things, basically on what you described, which is a fantastic description, you think feels like, oh, well, the narrative version or the story seems like a better thing because it gives context, it has more things, it's edited, it's made specifically, you can enhance the story, you can embellish the story, whatever mm-hmm. you want to do, right? The other one is, it is what it is.
Yeah.
That is a more honest way of looking at things, right? In a sense that if I go into Blurtasia.
It's unmediated.
Right. It's unmediated. It's, if I go into Blurtasia, Blurtasia is not telling me a story in a sense.
No.
I mean, it could, or I could interpret it as such.
Yeah, you might get a story you out might of get, it. But yeah.
That's all in my head, just like it would be me walking through a forest, right?
Or
me,
exactly.
And so when people go out on a beautiful hike, right, mm-hmm. that is not a narrative.
Yeah.
You can create a narrative about how amazing your hike was and all the amazing things that happened, but those are things that actually happened, right?
Yes.
And so then you turn that into a narrative, and that's the post-production part of it, I guess. But the actual going on a hike is kind of what you're expressing. Like, that is the thing that people are possibly ignoring a little bit in the VR world.
Yeah, I think it's in a sense, it has so many things in common with what we think of as story mm-hmm. that even the people who have maybe interesting ideas for experiences mm-hmm. are still seeing it through the eyes of story in a way that they're calling it story where it technically really isn't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You can have events and characters and things happening. And
I mean, you could have an experience where you're in a VR scenario and there's someone that's telling a story.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And
you can do anything.
Sure. But that does not necessarily mean that you're now part of the story.
Right. Well, and there's the neurological perspective on it, which I think is interesting. And again, I love stories. I don't want to diss stories. I've made movies all my life and love that and very proud of it. Mm-hmm. But it is a reality that neurologically we process language and storytelling and narrative in a very different way than we process experience.
Okay.
And spatial presence, which is really, I like to call it that because that really pins it down what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's really just the sense of being present in a place. It's your awareness of your location.
Mm-hmm.
And so normally most of the time we're talking to each other, we're telling each other stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not even aware of our spatial presence, you know, as you're talking, you forget the room or the place you are, the theater you're watching the movie in or whatever. Whereas there are times where that I think are some of the peak experiences for human beings is when the spatial presence in and of itself is so engaging that everybody just shuts up and is just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, this is just
you're not sitting
incredible.
There telling an amazing story.
And you are forced into the present, into the here and now, both spatially and temporally. You're just like, wow, I'm really here.
Right.
And so, and that's a different kind of experience. And I guess the thing that's hard to negotiate in all of this, if you really want to tell stories in VR, is to realize that if you are telling a compelling story, if you've got a story and the audience is really deeply engaged in it, that inhibits their ability to actually have an experience of spatial presence. Mm. And likewise, if you have a really engaging spatial experience, you're not going to pay attention to any story. You're too distracted. The way that, you know, at a fundamental level, the way the brain works is you have these different areas and these different mechanisms and they, any given thing that becomes excited is going to inhibit other things.
Okay.
So anything that becomes, that draws your attention will be captured. And other areas that might be paying attention to other things become suppressed to your awareness.
Okay.
And that's why you can go to the movie and forget you're in the theater and that there's, you know, the kids are all around you and the stuff's going on and that you're stuffing yourself with popcorn. You can eat a whole bag of popcorn and not even realize I didn't even realize I was so caught up in the story.
Right.
And so, you know, there's this sort of mutual suppression. We've only got so much attention to go around. And so if you engage people with a story, you're limiting their ability to have an experience of spatial presence, which is what VR offers.
It's an interesting point because I was talking about it with Dan Thrawn on a previous podcast about his thing about people keep talking about, it's all about, you know, total immersion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I can go to the movie theater and watch French Connection and I'm completely immersed in what's going on in the movie. I don't need that as a VR experience. That's a story being told to
That's
me.
Right.
And I ignore all the, just like you said,
That's
you ignore
right.
everyone around you.
You're in that world, yeah.
So you're not really in the presence there, right? You're not in the present. You're in the...
Well, it's interesting because... It's hard for us to even talk about it because we don't have words yet.
Right.
And because people argue about the definitions of the words.
Okay.
But in some schools, in the game areas, the scholars of gaming have come up with terminology for some of the things. And I've seen it called spatial presence, narrative presence, strategic presence.
What is strategic presence?
Tactical presence.
Okay.
So that's a strategic presence is in a game if you're trying to solve a puzzle.
Oh, and
you're
right.
trying to figure out, now, should I go around the back side? Will they come from around the edge? And how do I get to the top there? And maybe if I skirt the, you know, so anyway, that's the thing. And then the tactical is more just the like run, duck, shoot,
right.
hide, keep shooting,
right.
reload. Like,
right.
And so if you're engaged in any of these kinds of presence,
mm-hmm.
They're really presence is in a sense of, in this case,
it's engagement.
It's engagement right. or attention.
Okay.
And again, we only have so much to go around.
Right.
And you know, they're not, it's not like a, it's so mutually exclusive. It's not a hard on and off. It's a gradient for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a gradient that seeks complete absorption or complete attention.
Mm-hmm.
So you tend to want to be absorbed in one thing or the other.
Okay.
At any given time.
Yeah.
So I think if you're going to tell a story in VR and want to take advantage of spatial presence, it's probably a good idea to have, you know, work out some flow for how you're going to, okay, here's the, this will be the narrative presence part where you're really engaged in the story. And then here we're kind of going to let the story slide away and you're going to be all blown away by where you are.
Right.
I mean, movies do this.
Sure.
So it's, you know, it's part of the thing, but nonetheless, I think it's useful to know that if you're deeply engaged in a game or a movie,
mm-hmm.
you're throwing away the power of VR.
Right.
And likewise, if you really want to be, if you have deeply engaged people in a sense of spatial presence in
yep.
VR, a story or a game is just distracting. I find, I mean, you know, I always try to come up with these little euphemisms or analogies to describe the experience. And it's sort of like, well, okay, you're rappelling down a cliff with, you know, your friend or whatever. And, mm-hmm. And you're just taken in this incredible view. You can barely breathe. It's so terrifying in a sense, but breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, and your friend pulls out a little, you know, phone and says, "Hey, you want to watch The Godfather?" I mean, it's just like, what? Are you kidding? No. Like, or your friend starts telling you a story. Hey, you know, I saw Dave in the store the other day, and he was telling me about your sister, and you're just like, shut up! Don't you see where we are? Look at this,
right?
And then, you know, yeah, it's
I think I don't know if I've said it on the podcast before, but a lot of the people, as we know, who are involved in VR, right? If you look at you said there's a lot of game people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Game people are a huge community in the VR world, as are a lot of visual effects people, because there's a lot of similar tools that are being used across the board here. And what's interesting is I used the saying that when the only tool you know how to use is a hammer, all your problems look like nails, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like they're going to instinctively make a game for VR or make a movie for VR or do something that's what they know how to do, right?
Yes.
And so no one – it's kind of a great – just based on exactly what you just described where – no, it's not necessarily – you don't have to engage someone. You don't have to tell them a story. You don't have to do them. They can just be in the present, right? That is the argument I use where I think architecture is exactly that. You want to go experience the architecture.
Explore the space.
Explore
the shapes.
Space.
Yeah.
They're like, oh. And even for architectural design, it's so practical. It's like, oh, that's what my building is going to look like.
Yes.
Wow, that looks great. And then you get to see it in the real scale and everything else. I mean, that's a huge thing.
It is. And it's also that's why we love architecture.
Right.
Because it is a spatial experience.
Right.
It gives us that heightened peak experience of spatial presence when
right.
you walk into a huge entryway or a crazy
yeah.
domed cathedral or whatever.
That's why they made those cathedrals that way, is for you to shut up, as you said.
And, yeah. And
just look and go, you know,
yeah.
that's the
Well, and the other thing that hasn't really come out yet, but it's pretty clear to me that having, you know, explored everything from psychedelics to meditation to lucid dreaming and all manner of philosophy and everything, that spatial presence is a, you know, as a gateway drug to existential presence.
Okay.
And that's true in life, independent of virtual reality. People often have these sort of spiritual awakening, spiritual epiphanies, philosophical realizations, whatever you want to call it, transcendent experiences in incredible locations in nature.
Yes.
At the top of a mountain, or at the, you know, scuba diving or skydiving, or, you know, having these sort of peak spatial experience present experiences.
Yeah, I think that the sense of awesomeness, where you sense your scale by making something massive around you or something like that, that changes your, that's what makes things exciting, right?
In a sense. Yeah. There's a philosopher, Otto something, I can't think of his name, but he came up with this idea of mysterium tremendum fascinans.
Okay.
And that is the mystery that's terrifying but fascinating.
Okay.
And he described this as at the foundation of the origins of religion and spiritual thought and art.
Okay.
And in that it wasn't just about making a really beautiful thing. It was about making a thing that was simultaneously attractive, but also a little scary, little like it's really awe.
Right.
It's about the sublime. It's about having that experience of like, holy shit, you know, the reality has dropped out from underneath and you're left just having a pure experience of being.
Right.
And it's so fascinating. And this really, that phrase, mysterium tremendum fascinans, is, I see it in everything. It's so present. It's such a central factor in our engagement.
Yeah.
And so I think, and yet it's also a very, it's a positive thing, I think, in a sense. It's not, it doesn't engage us at our most base levels. It engages us at a higher level, at a transcendent level.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fascinating thing. And I think you're right. The problem I have is that it's hard to describe.
Yeah.
And it's hard to describe because there is a language problem now. We're all having to invent new language for describing why this is an important thing. And we're so used to telling stories and we're so used to being told stories.
Right.
That describing something that could inherently not be about story at all is actually can be challenging. And the best way I think of it is just like, imagine a building or an architecture, right? Because that's something I know. That's my hammer nail problem, right? Because I know architecture. That's what I used to do.
Yes.
And so I like, this works for me. This makes sense. But one thing I do think though is the architecture field itself has the ability, has the language. And here's why I feel that. I feel that it is an architect, by his or her very nature, has to describe a space that's not there, has to do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to have the atrium over here. So imagine if you go through here and you're narrating a spatial experience, right? And the architects do that, right? They don't do it like filmmakers. They do it like architects do, which is very nonlinear as well. They don't go, all right, picture this, a horse is on a carriage and you're taking that carriage and you're going, no. It's just like, it's completely, it allows you, if an architect does a really good job, they can describe the space and you can imagine it in your virtual reality brain, right? In your imagination. And that is the skill that an architect has, is to be able to sell you on something that's basically in their brain and have to transfer that to you. And so I feel that there's a language that's going on in the architecture world that's important that could help the virtual reality world. I actually feel that the virtual reality world needs to look to architecture more, because I went to the
I totally agree.
I went to the summit, the same one, the VR summit. Was that what it was called?
Vision Summit.
Vision Summit. Thank you. Yes, Vision Summit, which was great. And it had like one or two architectural presentations there. Mm-hmm. And they were good, but it was so small attendance. Yeah. And there were people like, yeah, I need to make some better environments because it's kind of boring, whatever. It's like, yes, well, first of all, you do have to make better environments.
Right.
And why not go to the architect for that instead of, you know, architects is one of the oldest professions in the world in terms of artistic professions.
Yeah.
And they should be leading some of the design that's going on in virtual reality and some of the environments that are created. You know, Blurtatia is a fantastic example of something that's really beautiful, but that's so rare.
Well, but it's interesting because, you know, I'm an artist, so I made an art thing.
Right.
And I think of it as an art thing. But Blurtatia is architecture.
It is, if anything. Absolutely.
It's shapes in space.
Right.
That's all I'm interested in.
It is. It is absolutely an architecture experience. And I think that's kind of what I'm getting at is it is an architectural experience.
Yes. And I think that's where thinking like an architect and learning to think and communicate with the language of architecture would be a huge benefit to people in VR because it really is. You know, VR is spatial presence. That's what the medium affords us. And so it's perfect for architecture. It's perfect for art and all manner of other things. But I think it's going to be really helpful for people to try to realize, transcend their various indoctrinations and realize that VR is something else, that its spatial presence is an entirely new communication medium.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to think of it in its own terms. And we, of course, you know, we have to find analogies and metaphors in order to give meaning to it. And I think architecture and art are very powerful ones.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're not explored enough. I think I think they're too foreign to people who are doing it. I think just based on what you said, the tools that are developed that out there that can naturally make VR happen just automatically fell into the game industry because you need some kind of a computer graphic to show what you're doing.
They built the devices.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So it's not – and architects are not necessarily a person who's going to build the device. They can take advantage of it. In fact, I should even note that VR has actually taken off quite a bit in architecture. It's just not publicized as much.
Right, right. That is a challenge we face both in art and architecture and in any number of other endeavors. I think it's an issue. I really am hopeful that VR will help to stem the tide and turn things around for us as a species and a civilization in terms of our values and the things we seek in our entertainment.
Right.
Because and don't get me wrong, I'm not a you know, a moral ethical fanatic. I have no militant need to reform the world,
right.
but you know, I've played games, my kids play games, my friends play games. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything against
and
it.
Games are not going away.
And games aren't going away.
Right.
But in games and in movies, and really kind of all forms of entertainment, we've gotten so good at it. We have distilled this formula for engagement and addiction and stimulation mm-hmm. into such a powerful essence that it has been reduced to porn in a sense.
Okay.
It appeals to and triggers our lowest basis instincts.
Okay.
Because that's where you mine the dopamine the most effectively.
Right. And people are willing to pay for it.
And if you want to really get that dopamine thing, blowing people's heads off and seeing them explode is pretty powerful stuff.
Right.
And so there's that.
Sure.
But it could be argued that this is cathartic and keeps people from, you know, releasing their frustrations in real life, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not making any big argument there. But the point I think I'm starting to realize that I think a lot of people are starting to realize, and it will be a gradual transition. It should be a gradual transition. But if we want to have less conflict and violence and mayhem in our lives, in our world, in our civilization, mm-hmm. we're going to have to be a little more selective and a little more refined and a little more disciplined in how we get our dopamine fixes.
Yeah.
And so, like, in a sense, that's what I'm trying to do with Zen Parade and Blurtasia, mm-hmm. is to try to show, look, we've got this incredible new medium now of spatial presence, mm-hmm. and there are a wealth of possibilities for creating incredibly powerful peak experiences of you know, dopamine extravaganzas,
right.
that have nothing to do with violence or tragedy or conflict at all.
Yeah.
And it's possible. And here now you're taking the thing that you love, that's maybe your, you know, your secret shame, or your, you know, maybe it's just your guilty pleasure, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And you turn, now it can be something that's actually good for you.
When a lot of people enjoy traveling, most people enjoy traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Most people like to go to a location, and they do? They don't sit in their hotel room and watch TV all day. They want to go out and explore new things and see big experiences. You go into Cancun, you're not going to stay in your hotel room. You're going to go out on the beach and go, wow, look how beautiful this beach is.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an experience that you can do. And you do get dopamine from experiencing that, mm-hmm. that presence. So it's the same analogy that I think, you know, architecture, travel, these are things that I think are really, it's a lot of reason why I love what Eric Hansen is doing over at you know, at X-Rays.
Oh,
they're,
yeah.
Those are beautiful. I got to go to Iceland. I got to go to base camp at Everest. You know, I got to see these things. It'd be really, going to base camp at Everest would be, it's hard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's really hard.
But
yeah.
I got to be as close as I've ever been to that place, right?
Right. Yep.
So those are great things to experience, and that's something you would love to do, you know?
Well, it's funny because I'm always teasing Eric about this, and he teases me that the thing that most artists will tell you that I think most people don't realize is that I think, and it's true for architects as well, I would imagine.
Sure.
That all we're trying to do is, you know, ape what nature does.
Right.
We're just trying to be as beautiful as nature.
Right.
And to create something as cool and as awesome and as engaging and as beautiful and overwhelming and transcendent as, you know, the 12 apostles or,
yep.
you know, and I think it's true for buildings too. You're just trying to create, wow, yeah, that looks cool. It's like, you know, that looks like the mountains, or it looks
right.
like Mount Fuji, or it looks like this or that. And so I think it's kind of an ironic thing. And like, I don't know, with my abstract art,
right.
talking with Eric about it, he shows me something he went and shot that's in nature that's weirder than anything I could have possibly. Like, and my thing's all crazy psychedelic. It's like, no, reality is way crazier. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get a lot of unexpected things in reality. That's true. But I think that you are freed in a lot of ways, right? From like Blurtasia as an example, you are freed from the constraints of gravity. You are freed from the constraints of construction, or the fact that you can have a, you know, while you said it's an architectural space, which is correct, it's also a completely dynamic space. It's constantly moving and changing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is a big deal, that it's always doing something. It's always part of it. And that is also very freeing from architecture. And that's another reason why I think designers, architectural designers, should be part of that, because they suddenly will have the ability. I mean, if Zaha Hadid, she's not alive anymore, but if she was still alive, she could make an incredible VR experience of a design space,
mm-hmm.
you know? Giving up gravity is going to be a hard one, or having the option to give up gravity in a sense, right? Because you still, when you're in VR, your body is still in gravity in some ways, right? So you still...
Well, you're... Physically, it is.
Yeah,
you're going to still feel the sensations, but people seem to think that the brain and our perceptions or something are like they're hardwired, and they're really quite plastic. You know, if you spend any time in a float tank at all, you'll realize that your body image is not very well, you know, solidified. It will drift and distort, and pretty soon you feel like you're doing somersaults and you're shaped like an onion ring or something. Like, you don't, you know, you lose your body image pretty easily.
Interesting.
And what I found in Blurtasia, what's really fun, if you get to flying around, if you let go of the platform, and now you're just a couple of controllers and a head. And there are sculptures in there where they're these kind of complex woven cave structures or whatever, with little openings that your head can just fit through. And you can fly through those and through these caves and openings that your body can't fit through. And yet it's a strange sensation that actually can change your body image as you go through. Suddenly you're not a whole body. You're no bigger than your head.
Right.
And there's all kinds of things that can be done. And you asked earlier about what I've learned.
Yeah.
And one of the big things... which, you know, I'd thought about, but the actual reality of it really was much more impressive once I started experimenting in VR. And it's that we have this, and I've been part of it in computer graphics, this obsession with the replication of reality.
Okay.
That we wanted just like, oh, the shadows aren't quite right. We got to get that just right. Because, you know, in visual effects, we're often trying to make CG things look like they belong in a photographed reality. And so that obsession with reality is strong. But in any kind of, I mean, that's just a thing that goes back to painting and everything else. It's that trying to duplicate nature, trying to duplicate reality. And what I've realized is that when you're in VR, that's less important. It's still a factor and will be for a little while, but it's interesting to think about that reality has its own, you know, incredible real-time ray tracing. Like, it's just so good. And so it has all these capabilities, but it also has a lot of limitations, the limitations of physics and gravity and, you know, material science, et cetera, et cetera. Human factors.
Right.
Computer graphics has limitations. You can only render so many frames a second and so many materials, so many polygons, et cetera. But it's missing a whole lot of the limitations of reality. And I think it's important to embrace the things that we can do that we can't do in reality.
Okay.
And I really feel like we're going to discover a whole new way of thinking about reality. We're going to let go of our attachment to trying to duplicate reality. And that's what I'm trying to do with Blurtasia, is just like, okay, forget about reality. What can I imagine as a possible reality?
Yeah.
And what's possible in virtual reality? What does a virtual reality from 1,000 years from now look like?
Sure. I think another big factor to me is there is a confusion between reality and photoreality, just like you were saying, because photoreality is about matching the technology, literally, look of a photograph, right? So depth of field, lens flares.
All the artifacts.
And the more we see those artifacts, the more we feel that it looks real. But that's only because we've experienced this from filmmaking, right?
Yes.
So bokeh depth of field with, you know, seeing the shape of the shutter, of the hexagon shutter, your eyes never do that, right?
Yeah, right.
So don't start introducing lens flares in VR.
Don't start introducing...
Depth of field in VR. It's just confusing. Things don't actually look fuzzy and out of focus to you in reality, because your mind is always focusing on things.
Yeah, there's a lot of debates that go on about that stuff, and I just shake my head. It's hard having thought about all this stuff for you know, 50 years mm-hmm. and now everybody's discovering it and stumbling over a lot of the same
issues,
the same issues and assumptions. We all have our indoctrinations. Mm-hmm. But I think, we all have to constantly struggle to, accommodate and look at possibilities that exceed them.
Do you feel that you mentioned that the community is something you've really embraced. It's being a great community in VR now.
Yes, yeah.
And do you feel it's collaborative? Obviously, from your experience, it seems very collaborative to help out. And what I mean by collaborative, it meaning like the people help each other out if they need help.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of that. And it's I think that everyone in it is an evangelist for the medium, mm-hmm. and we all want to see it succeed and become widely adopted. And so a lot of the normal competition and so on is set aside.
Okay.
Because any of us succeeding helps all of us.
Okay.
So I think there's a lot of that and a lot of people, you know, we're all just figuring it out.
Right.
And so there's a lot of wanting to help each other, mm-hmm. Because, again, you know, it we want everybody's thing to be better and help to keep VR going.
Right, right, right. Well, that's nice to hear. And it's good to hear that community is going to help each other out. Part of it always seemed a little bit competitive in a sense. Because I think there's a lot of, we've got technology that the other people don't have kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, of course, it's at this point already dominated by big business interests.
Sure.
And so that's a whole other species with their own indoctrinations.
Right.
And it's, of course, central and important, but it's, I don't consider that the community. The
right.
community
you,
are the people.
The content creators.
Yeah, the content creators is the community more.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's I think my greatest fear for virtual reality is that it will be like so many other things that I've seen come and wonderful things come into being in my lifetime that are consumed and destroyed by business.
Yeah.
And it's that whole thing. And I it's not, it's easy to think of it in a, like it's malevolence or something. There's some kind of evil or whatever, but I've seen how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a fundamental problem we face as humans in that you start out with ideally with a mission or an idea. Something you want to do to contribute to the world, something that helps people or lessens their suffering somehow. And so that now you want to do that, and it takes money to do that. So you have to have a business in order to make enough money to keep doing it,
right,
keep providing
right.
this service. And so now you advertise, you do the things that business people do, and now you take on as a creative, you're solving one kind of problem, and as a business person, you're solving a different kind of problem, and generally with problem solving, whatever it's focused on, it's about optimization.
Okay,
and I've found that as an artist, I'm militant about my art is untainted.
Okay.
I make it for its own sake. I've made it all these years. I haven't really profited from it. It's just a thing I have to do and love to do, and I want to share it.
Mm-hmm.
I've made my living from the film industry.
Right.
That's, you know, I stand by. I think that's a great thing too.
Right.
But my art, I think of art as being, it needs to be this thing. It can't be tampered with that way.
Okay.
If it makes money, great.
Sure.
But it can't be altered in order to make money.
Right.
So in business, though, it's like once you start optimizing the function to make money, whether it's for your paintings, you know, your
right.
art, or for a widget or a VR headset or whatever it is, that's a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
And so once you start optimizing for the most efficient means to profit, you are inevitably sacrificing the good that that product will provide.
Yeah.
And the biggest way that happens is, well, in order to make this profitable, because the thing costs money to make, it has to appeal to the most people possible.
Right.
And in order to appeal to the most people possible, it has to be average.
Yes.
And not just average, but it has to appeal at a very base level, that thing we were talking about earlier of just like, oh, this hits my dopamine button and it's porn.
Yeah.
And so how do we as a civilization, how do we negotiate this thing?
This happens all the time. I mean, we were talking about it. I did a podcast with Dan Thron. And we can go back to that one. We talked about Jurassic Park, and we said that, like, Jurassic World is the ultimate example of about as average as possible across the board, to the point where everyone was just kind of like generally, they gave all the general things that people wanted.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it gave all the thrills, et cetera, but it was like, it's about as, you know, mushed together. And that was Dan's point about it. And I think that's true, that you try to make things appealing to the wide audience.
And you're giving people what they think they want.
Or what they've been told they want.
It isn't. It's more what they think they want.
Right.
Because now everybody's making stuff based on big data, mm-hmm. and all of these, you know, focus groups and all of that stuff. So the demographics, all that stuff comes in. And so you find out, wow, what people really want is another Jurassic Park movie or, you know, whatever. And it's true. This is all valid information. Mm-hmm. But people don't really know what they really want. They only know what they think they want.
Sure.
And sometimes that is what they want. They might enjoy that, whatever, but they're nothing new is produced that way.
Mm.
You cannot get any innovation, or it really is the death of creativity to focus on giving people what they think they want.
Yeah.
And based on all this information and everything. And in history, you know, you go back and you look at the big successes and you really look into it. You find, oh, well, this movie appealed to lots of people and was hugely successful. Yeah. And it was original and innovative. And it's like, yeah. And that doesn't happen very often.
Right.
And it is where people go out on a limb and make a thing that isn't a remake of something else that's something completely new.
This happens all the time where they will go, okay, no, we're never going to make Deadpool when they first did that. And suddenly like, oh, wait, an R-rated superhero movie actually successful? Now we're going to make 18 of them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. Well, and it always comes to the thing of like, okay, what do you really want? Well, I want something great that I've never seen before.
Right.
That would be your first choice. Well, that doesn't happen very often. What's your second choice? Something great that I've seen before. Yeah. And so we're reduced to getting second choices,
right?
Because of the, you know, the pressures of the business and the shareholders and having to be profitable.
Well, people's like, they are guaranteed a good time because they already know what they're going to get.
Yeah.
Right? So, so if they're paying, you know, $18 a ticket now for a movie for a whole family, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, I better know what I'm getting when I'm spending that kind of money. Yeah. Right. It's a little sad. We've discussed that in a few other ones, and yeah, those are the dangers of the industry we're in right now, and that's how you're absolutely right that focus groups do that, and VR is subject to that. There are people out there that are telling people, like you were saying, don't accelerate in VR. It's like, why can't I accelerate? Let's explore that.
Yeah,
you know, Ed Ulbricht said the same thing about. He's like, you can move in VR, and I've seen it done, and you can even move very fast in VR.
Yeah,
and it's not that it will make you sick. You just there are other things that people need to explore.
Yeah.
What is the biggest surprise to you? What is it? You know, what is one of the things like I did not expect that, or that was something that I learned that I didn't think about, or that's happened. I know you've been doing this for a long time. You got into VR with your first, you were talking about it when you were in elementary school.
Yeah, the ViewMaster.
You saw ViewMaster. Yeah. That was your first VR experience.
Yeah.
As a little kid.
Yeah, it kind of was. Yeah, I remember thinking very clearly at 3 years old that when my mom came to pick me up and I had to give the ViewMaster back to go home from nursery school, that that I would fight them one at a time or both at once or whatever. I would die before I would give back this ViewMaster that didn't belong to me. It was mine, and they'd just have to deal with that.
Yeah. But I mean, but what have you learned recently about VR that you was not expected?
Well, it's I hate to keep going back to the thing of the things I've been learning are really less to do with VR than
perception,
than the world.
The world.
How the world works and business and the indie game world and
all
that.
But isn't that really cool that VR has allowed you to think about those things in a sense?
It is. It's so exciting. It's like I'm getting to start over and it's very much like the early days of computer graphics and visual effects. And I was there and got to help pioneer that whole thing and ride that wave. And it was so much fun. And this really feels like that. Complete with all of the risk and anxiety as to whether it will happen or not. But I'm trying to think in terms of VR. I think I've been surprised. A lot of these things were theories I had. Mm-hmm. But I've realized upon seeing them proven out that I really didn't believe they were true. Okay. Somehow I was surprised to find they were actually true. So for instance, this notion of altering consciousness with just audiovisual stimulation. Mm. And, people have talked about that, directors have aspired to that. Yoderowski is like, I want to make a movie that's an acid trip,
Right.
And of course, it's all successful to some extent or to whatever extent. But the thing about VR is that a lot of the mechanisms that underlie the effects on consciousness by media are greatly amplified by immersion in a headset.
Mm.
So all of the things are just kind of amped up.
Right.
So one of the things I've been into for many years is neural entrainment, often called brainwave entrainment.
Okay.
And this is the phenomenon of frequency-based oscillations in a certain proximity to each other will sync.
Right.
And so, you can have a bunch of mechanical clocks in a room and they will eventually sync up through subtle, not well understood phenomenon of oscillation of air molecules and whatnot. And I think probably there's something even happening at a quantum level. So there's some weird stuff going on.
Okay.
But it works with human brains in that if you present a pulse to the ears or to the eyes of a certain frequency, and then that is maybe representative of our normal waking general brainwave state.
Mm-hmm.
You can now, over a period, you can ramp that down or ramp it up or do different things with it. And the brain, the dominant frequency of brainwaves will correspond.
Interesting.
And those dominant frequencies correspond to certain mental states.
Right.
So you can be hypnotized down into the alpha or into theta.
Mm-hmm.
You can be calm and relaxed. You can be put in a meditative state through neural entrainment.
Hmm.
You can be excited and brought to a state of hypervigilance.
Right.
So that's well documented as being an effective thing. They use it to treat lots of things, but it's not the most studied thing in the world. And unfortunately, it is, I would say the majority of the people selling it and, practicing it are pitching it in all kinds of ways that are just ridiculous. So, you know, it's a real thing, but it's also, it's, you know, be careful. There's a lot of snake oil folks out there selling it, doing things that it can't really do. Anyway, that's one of the things that, wow, in VR, that stuff is powerful. That it works.
Interesting.
And it doesn't have to be necessarily the, you know, there's a whole sort of process for doing it through binaural beats or there's another one. Isochronic beats is another form of it. It's not really necessary. Music, any kind of rhythmic music is a form of neural entrainment.
Right.
And so I've kind of moved into thinking of it more artistically.
Hmm.
But I think that kind of, as much as I had hoped for it and theorized about it, mm-hmm. the fact that you can put people into a pretty altered state of consciousness, give them a real transcendent experience
mm-hmm.
in VR, kind of the first few times we had people, even in Zen Parade, mm-hmm. come out of it crying, claiming their life had changed, mm-hmm. that they'd had some spiritual awakening or... you know, it's different for all kinds of people. That's not everybody. People have different experiences.
Right.
And some of that is just the power of VR.
Right.
It's so amazing to see the computational process that is begun when a person has their first VR experience. And especially in something like Zen Parade or Blurtasia, which is a more sort of existential, artistic kind of thing. And you see the gears kind of turning and they realize it's a set of assumptions or a set of, just leaps or of understanding where you go, okay, so, wow, this is amazing. I'm in a thing and it feels like reality, even though it doesn't, it's not as real as reality.
Yeah.
And then they go, well, if you can do this, then in theory, with a little more technology, a little more advancement, we'll be able to make this so that it's indistinguishable from reality.
Right.
And as soon as you realize that, something happens to not everyone, but to a lot of people, if they hadn't ever thought of it before, and they suddenly realize, well, then what the hell is reality? And it undermines at a fundamental level their taking for granted reality as being this sort of base substrate of existence or right. something. It's questionable. It's suddenly like, well, wait a minute.
Isn't kind of like the theory where the closer we are to being able to simulate a world, the closer we are to actually being in a simulated world.
Yeah. Yeah. Or realizing that
wait a minute, my whole reality could actually be completely simulated.
Well, in a sense, it certainly is.
Right.
And, you know, whether that's some virtual reality that's mediated by an intelligence off somewhere with some advanced technology. Well, that we don't know anything about that.
Sure.
But even just from the perspective of we perceive reality through our brain and
my reality can look very different from your reality.
Well, yeah, but we don't actually directly perceive reality. It is well understood that neurologically we're perceiving a model of reality that we have built from data that we're taking in through our senses.
Yes.
And absolutely. So it's a pretty interesting thing. And I think that was always the thing people would talk about in those altered state experiences, whether that's meditation or lucid dreaming or psychedelics,
mm-hmm.
this idea that, you know, people are like, well, man, that's dangerous stuff. If you can't tell reality from the trip, you know, what are you going to do? And it's like, well, I've had visions all my life, long before any experimenting with any hallucinogen or anything. I was already having full-on, absolutely vivid, realistic visions. And I never confused them. I never, even as a little kid, I knew this was different than reality. It was right. every bit as real, in some cases more real. It never made me, you know, believe, you know, when the aliens are talking to me, I know that they're somehow some whatever. I don't know. I don't judge it, but I know it ain't the reality other folks see.
Sure.
And all it ever did was make me go and question, okay, so what's going on with this supposed reality thing? Mm-hmm. I think it has many qualities in common with these things that I know are not real.
Right.
And so I think maybe eventually this notion of real, not real dissolves because it's meaningless. There's just our experience.
Right.
And there is no evidence, and never has been any evidence, for the existence of an objective world. It's just, right. there isn't, it's, there's, and there's, it would be impossible to ever know.
Yeah.
We'll never know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Well, we're over time, but I think this has been a fascinating talk. And I know that a lot of our listeners are going to be enjoying it. I will try to, I'd love to know what their thoughts are on it. And I'd love for them to give us feedback after they experience the things at Blurtasia and all those other things. And make sure when you guys do that, make sure and give a review and let people know, because those are very important things for Kevin to be able to share his art on in VR, is, you know, give some good feedback on it, because I think it's a really wonderful experience.
It's really hard to sell a thing that nobody has any way to understand or describe.
Right.
And so it's we're finding the only way we sell it is by getting people to try it.
Right. Yeah.
And so yeah, I hope folks will try it. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's definitely fun. A really great experience. And I really love the fact that I can move around and I feel that motion and I have control of it. And it's a really good thing. The Vive is a very, very well suited for that, for that experience.
Yeah, it's really an incredible device. And
that's cool.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the one thing you'd ask, I just thought of something I learned that's okay. kind of exciting and I think encouraging for artists and creators in all the fields.
Yeah.
There is a moment here where VR is new. It's a whole new thing. Nobody knows what it is. Nobody fully understands its potential. And all the big players have jumped in. You know, there's all the big companies are in it and exploring it and trying to do it. But it's actually the first time, and this has been building for decades, mm-hmm. where technology really makes it possible for an individual, especially now in VR, because it hasn't been bought up and controlled by, you know, the entertainment industrial complex.
Ecosystems of whatever that is. Yeah.
But I'm, you know, I'm just an individual artist mm-hmm. and I'm going up against Disney
yeah.
and ILM and, you know, all the studios and all these companies, and I'm able to deliver a thing, you know, that competes with that.
Right.
And it's, I don't know how long that'll last, but
sure.
I hope it continues. And I would really encourage people to get into VR and make something new.
Yeah. That's a great way of putting it. Just, and make something experiential.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Experiential.
Explore the medium, see yeah. what it does.
And it's, and by doing that trying to do something experiential can actually be very freeing in a lot of ways, right? So
yeah,
for sure.
Oh yeah, no, I love the experimental process.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much, Kevin. I really
Thank
appreciate you coming by.
I really appreciate it. Thanks.